Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge you who may care about or care for or have become someone with a disability. Disrespect welcomes Michael Shapcott, policy researcher for the Wellesley Institute and national housing and homelessness advocate for 25 years. You're what, chair of the network?
I'm chair of the National Housing and Homelessness Network, that's right, yeah.
Okay. Michael, we had a stab at this interview yesterday, and you've been kind enough to come back, and what we were talking about was what I called the hiatus in homeless funding, which you elaborated on and indicated it affects a lot of programs in addition to explicit funding for homeless people, and that its status is still somewhat unclear. How did this come to be? We're talking federal now, right?
We're talking federal, and the thing I really want to emphasize, Jeff, is that, you know, sometimes these very critical political discussions get caricatured into, you know, right versus left and socialists versus conservatives or whatever, and as if somehow they're just these debates between extremists, political extremists, and when really what it's about is the kind of communities we want to live in and the kind of country we want to live in and how the government can support that. And governments can support it. And we know that when we had national housing programs, provincial, local housing initiatives, that we had less homelessness. By the 1990s, I can remember in the 1990s when we began to see for the first time entire families showing up at homeless shelters. We began to see young kids.
That was a change, wasn't it?
It was a huge change. And then by the mid to late 1990s, we began to see young women who were pregnant actually giving birth to their babies on the streets, homeless. There was a...
Literally on the street.
In downtown Toronto, Nathan Phillips Square, a pregnant woman gave birth at Nathan Phillips Square. She had no home, and she couldn't get to a hospital. You know, these things were shocking at the time. Now I think people kind of, because we've had a few years, maybe a decade or so of mass homelessness, people are beginning to get a bit dulled. But there actually was a time when it wasn't quite so bad. What began to happen in the late 1990s, as mass homelessness got really, really bad, as the housing crisis began to affect not just the poorest of the poor, but even middle-income people were struggling to be able to pay the rent, feed the kids. We began to see governments starting to put back together again what I call the patchwork of funding, a little bit of money here for some new housing, a little bit of money there for some homeless programs. And
what is the sincerity of that register with you?
Well, I think that it wasn't a commitment to, like we had back in the 60s and 70s, to the government being a partner, putting in stable long-term funding, and you know, really wanting to be part of the solution, but it was politically expedient. The federal homelessness minister back in 1999, when she first announced the federal homelessness program, she did it about 4 days before Christmas at a youth shelter in downtown Toronto, and it was so clearly it was pitched as a media message and was almost incidental. And oh yeah, we got a bit of money to throw away. But
how long have we had a homelessness minister now?
Well, we've actually had a homelessness minister in Canada since 1999. It was March of 99 when we got our first homelessness minister,
right.
And
Christmas before she acted.
Yeah, but she took a number of months to kind of figure out what needed to be done. We've gone through a few ministers since then, and we of course we've got an entirely different government as of January of 2000. And six, and got a new federal homelessness minister. What happened back in 1999 was that the government announced a pot of money for a federal homelessness program, and the official name of the program is the Supporting Community Partnerships Initiative.
Right.
If you take the first letter of each word, it spells out SCIPI, and that's what the program became known as. And it was about $135 million or so dollars a year.
And according to you, this hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed over the years. We did fight for some important changes, and some changes were made. For instance, originally the program was only supposed to go to nine nine of the biggest cities across the country. And we pointed out that, in fact, homelessness is not just a big city problem, although cities like Toronto, the biggest city in the country, definitely has the most number of homeless people, but it's also a small town, remote, rural, northern issue. Eventually, after some political pressure, the government agreed with us, and they decided to start shipping some money out to smaller communities. But instead of adding new money to the pot, what they did was they just took the same pie and they just cut the slices a little bit smaller. And what that meant was, you know, after a year or two, the federal homelessness money was going to about 61, 62 communities across the country. But nobody was getting very much because it was the same $135 million. That program was originally 3 years. It was renewed again after the end of 3 years for another 3 years. And it was due to expire last year, which, of course, 2005. Just literally days before the federal election that was called in towards the end of 2005, the Liberal government announced a one-year extension of the homelessness program, and that's the year we're in now. So what we're in is we're in literally the last year of a program, or at least the last year for which there's any funding. We thought that the funding was fairly secure. One of the first things that we did when the new Conservative government was elected in January was we got them to promise that they would honor the one-year extension for the homelessness program, and they said they would. The real issue for us is that as of March 31st, 2007, the entire program is dead unless there's new funding put into it by the government.
There's no encouragement that that's going to change, is there?
There's no promise, no commitment. In fact, we've had a very ominous statement from the federal finance minister, Jim Flaherty, who was down in New York City, and he was promising all of the money interests, the big bankers and so on down New York City, that his government was going to cut. And, of course, bankers like to hear that from politicians. And one of the things he specifically mentioned was the federal homelessness program, and he said this is the kind of thing the federal government shouldn't be spending money on.
I have information here from the Star, which says that this isn't just for people who are homeless, although it's opened a lot of shelter beds. It's also opened a lot of permanent housing. It's also helped people obtain identification documents to get off the streets and health care and jobs. But the Star says without the federal money, in October, the city's forced to stop accepting new clients, and that, in fact, they'll have to start giving notice to staff.
Well, Jeff, although this is called the Federal Homelessness Program, in fact, in Canada, for most homeless people, their experience of homelessness is periodic. They may spend a week or two or a month or two on the streets, and they're able to find somewhere, you know, maybe stay with some friends or family or whatever. So it's not a permanent situation. Some people move in and out of homelessness, but this homelessness program it not only helps people who are currently homeless, but it also helps people who are on the brink of homelessness,
yeah.
People who are teetering there. This federal homelessness program it provided a lot of good things in Toronto and communities, the other communities across the country where it funded. It paid for what's called transitional housing, which is housing that homeless people can move into. They can get stabilized, stay there for a few months until they move into some more permanent housing. So it's funded thousands and thousands of units of transitional housing across the country.
Wasn't it also behind these rent banks and these utility payment banks as well?
It helped to provide some money. Some of that money came from a couple of other initiatives, including rather tragically and ironically, when the federal government a few years ago announced its child tax credit, and the Ontario government decided that it wouldn't allow people who are on income assistance on welfare to keep it,
right,
and clawed it back. What the provincial government did was it took the money it clawed back from welfare recipients and put it into a homeless fund, which homeless prevention fund, I should say, which went into the rent bank and the energy bank and things like that. So
yeah,
that's where the homeless funding, in addition to paying for transitional housing, it also paid for capital improvements to programs that provide food for homeless people, and also for anybody else that's hungry, which
provides
a lot
food
of poor
banks,
people.
Right?
Food
banks, which
food
is
banks, but
questionably
also,
food.
Yeah, well, it also provides things. It was able to organizations that provide meals, for instance, for people, because many homeless people, of course, don't have cooking facilities. And so if you go into a food bank and somebody hands them a can of beans, it's kind of a nice concept. But if you don't have, well, I guess beans you can eat cold, but you know, bag of rice, let's say, not much use if you're homeless. So the what used to be called soup kitchens, and they're now drop-in centers, community food programs, they were able to get funding for new fridges, new cooking facilities, homeless shelters where people are allowed to stay for a short period of time in order to get them out the cold in the winter or the heat in the summer. The shelters were getting money for better air circulation systems and other improvements to make them healthier and safer.
Pretty basic stuff. I actually visited a shelter recently where they were very proud that a resident had left behind a microwave so that they could have one to rewarm food for people who couldn't be in at the set meal times.
Well, you know, anyone that's visited a shelter will know that they are they provide very modest level of comfort. You know, you're out of the rain, and so on. But the Skippy program was able to just to add a little bit more comfort to it. But one other element of the Skippy program that I wanted to mention was is funding for services. And you talked about one, the ID program. You know, one of the basic things that most people need in order to, for instance, get a job or get access to health care or get access to income assistance like welfare, they need ID. And many homeless people, they've been robbed or they've lost their ID.
You can't afford to pay for new.
You can't afford to pay the $20, $40, $60. And that's a very, very big barrier for people. And so these ID programs, which are literally serving thousands of people every year and providing the most basic practical help that you could possibly imagine, all these are doomed to be shut down. And, you know, I mentioned the programs going till March of 2007. The reason why it's they're talking about having to shut down as early as mid-October is that many of these programs, they figure that they have to give proper notice to their staff. You know, they've got to make an order. They've got to start an orderly wind down if there's not going to be any more money. Also, in these ID programs, it takes 2 to 3 months once you send off your request for the ID to actually come back again. So, so they're putting everyone on notice that if we don't hear by, you know, and some programs are saying late September, some are saying mid-October, then they're going to have to begin to start winding things down.
Yeah.
So the clock is ticking. The deadline is approaching very, very quickly. And in the scale of things, the kind of money that's that is needed, you know, $135 million for the federal government is a pretty tiny change when you think that, you know, they run an annual surplus of anywhere from $8 billion to $12 billion a year. Yet when it comes to doling out a few bucks to provide practical help for people who will literally live and die based on some of these programs, you know, the government grumbles and moans and complains about scarce dollars. So, you know, it really is fundamentally about values, and it's about the expectations that people have of government. And, you know, I think we expect our government to be a partner with people and a partner with communities in dealing with these problems.
And now for a short break from our interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Housing Advocate Michael Shapcott of the Wellesley Institute explain the implications of the potential suspension of federal SCPI grants in March.
The 2007 timing of this indicates that it has the potential to become certainly a provincial election issue, potentially a federal election issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the spark seems to be lacking. What needs to be done? Get this on the table.
When they go out and just ask people to sort of rhyme off the top of their head, what are the important issues to them? They often mention things like the environment, things along that, health care and so on. Those
latitudes,
typically
yeah.
get up at the top of the list. You don't often hear people say housing or homelessness, but if you go at it a different way, and there are some polling companies like Polera and Ipsos Reid and Ecos that have asked some more targeted questions, and what they find out is that if you start to ask people, then housing and homelessness pop up to the top of the list very, very quickly. There's not a household where people are in the low, moderate, middle-income category that aren't directly experiencing the problems of skyrocketing rents, the lack of income to cover the cost of shelter.
So do I hear you correctly? This is already on the table, but it's being swept aside.
Well, I think that it's an issue that's sort of below the surface politically, and that's really one of the jobs of housing advocates is to get housing onto the agenda.
Right.
You know, what politicians have hoped over the years. I mentioned, you know, just before Christmas of 1999, when the federal homelessness minister got onto her sleigh with her reindeer and wanted to play Santa Claus. What they hope is that if they dole out a little bit of money, that everybody will say, "Gosh, thanks very much," and people will go away and the problem will be solved, and they'll go vote for them in the next election.
Right.
In fact, that's not been happening because, of course, the amount of money they've been committing has been both short-term and it's been inadequate to meet the need. And so people haven't been packing up and going away and saying, thank you very much. They've been saying this is a down payment, but you've got to keep going.
Well, on the flip side, too, I mean, the incomes that a lot of these people get are inadequate to provide, to even allow them to go out and find their own housing.
That's absolutely right.
So there's no housing, there's no income.
Yeah, and that is an important issue to mention, Jeff, because in a city like Toronto, you have the very, very strange phenomenon that you have a housing waiting list maintained by the City of Toronto for affordable housing, where there's 65,000, 70,000 households, not individuals, but households, so total number of individuals could be a couple of hundred thousand people altogether on that list. So you've got this waiting list that's growing, that's huge. At the same time, you've got a rental vacancy rate that's creeping up. There's now about, last year there were about 10,000 vacant units in the private rental market. And people ask, how is it you can have empty, vacant rental units and this huge and growing waiting list? And the answer, of course, is that the folks on the waiting list can't afford vacant apartments. The average rent in Toronto is now around 11 for a two-bedroom apartment is about $1,100 a month. You need about $35,000 a year household income to support that. So we've got a fundamental failure, a collapse of the private rental market. It can't meet the housing needs of low, moderate, even middle-income households anymore. So you can have this very strange phenomenon of empty units and a huge waiting list.
I want to be perfectly clear with any listener about where I stand on this issue, because I have very strong viewpoints and I don't want to try and hide them. I myself have been dealing with Housing Connections, and I've been on their waiting list for 13 years. And basically they're saying, just let us help you. And then on the other side, they're saying the rules say there's nothing we can do. And I'm wondering where this is at the municipal level. We have a municipal election pending much sooner than spring 2007, and it's going to be an issue in time for the municipal election with the discontinuation of these programs and the layoff notices. Where do people like Housing Connections, who manage the waiting list, where do they stand as advocates on this?
Well, there is another interesting story, and as somebody who's been on the list for 13 years, I guess I should tell you to take heart, because statistically speaking, on average, people should only have to wait about 15 to 17 years. So you're getting close. You're getting close to the average time, and maybe one of these years you'll actually get that magic phone call.
Well, sadly, the unit that I've been on the list for 13 years, my health has deteriorated to the point where it's no longer suitable, and I have new listings, for which I'm told I will also have to wait at least 13 years.
No, absolutely. And if you do the math, you take the 65,000, just to round off the numbers, not exactly 65,000, but if you do that and you realize that each year the city is able to house about 4,000 people off that list, then you begin to understand why it is that people have to wait 15 years or whatever on average. Just the straight math proves that.
Can we count on the organizations who manage these ghastly waiting lists to advocate for the people on them?
When you begin to ask, why is the social housing waiting list, why is this list so long, and why is it getting longer all the time? We've got a double whammy of a problem. We've already got a huge backlog of existing need, and the city is continuing to grow, and the need for housing is continuing to grow.
I don't hear anything about the people in the industry actually taking on an advocacy role. What do you think that a listener can do now to bring this into the framework of the municipal election and ensure that there's something to build on for the coming provincial and federal elections for housing advocates who will need a foundation of support?
I'm not trying to talk myself out of a job, but I like to say to people that housing policy is not rocket science. It's not like we've suddenly forgotten how to, you know, put the bricks together and build a building. We know how to do that. We actually have people who are very skilled at doing that, and I guess I want to tell your listeners that back in the 90s when there was a wholesale slashing of housing programs, a lot of the people that were employed as developers of affordable housing, they of course lost their jobs, and a number of them we sent to places like South Africa and the Philippines and other places around the world to help those countries to build housing because they couldn't get work here in Canada.
Right.
And now what we're doing is bringing some of those folks back to Canada, and we're saying we need you again, and we want to try and kickstart the program. So
are they coming back?
They are. And the important message to people about housing issues is that the solutions are very much within our grasp. What's been missing has been the commitment, the funding to make it happen. And I think the most important thing is for people to speak up, to say this: that I'm concerned about the housing crisis, I'm concerned about the homelessness disaster, and I want to see politicians begin to take it on. And we've got a municipal election, as you mentioned, in November. Next October, that's October 2007, there's a provincial election, and there probably will be a federal election sometime between the municipal and the provincial, although who knows.
We'll look forward to getting back to you at that time, especially if any profile emerges for housing issues related to the elections.
Sounds great.
All right.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks for your time, Michael.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to housing advocate Michael Shapcott of the Wellesley Institute explain the implications of the potential suspension of federal SCIPI grants in March. Before we go, housing worker Tammy Holm has let us know that the 12 noon September 12th Homeless Memorial Vigil in Trinity Square on the Bay Street side of the Eaton Center will be dedicated to renewal of the federal SCIPI grants for homeless programs, discontinuation of which will result in layoffs this fall. And for your morning smile, John Clark has told me the August 30th action planned by OCAP to restore the basketball court for the Mount Olive community was preempted when the city heard of it and showed up on August 28th and restored the court for them. At the break, you heard The Boogie Woogie by Honey Hill. And coming up, Oscar's Boogie with Oscar Peterson from a German recording by Membran Music. Thank you. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. To find out what we plan for the show, go to www.calendric.com/disrespect. That's C-A-L-E-N-D-R-I-C. www.calendric.com/disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.